I always was someone who would just knee-jerk reaction would always be to defer to everybody else and never kind of trust my own gut. And sometimes when you do that, you end up deferring to the wrong people.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. A good partnership is one of the most difficult things to have in a business. Why difficult? Because it's so full of risk. I often compare business partnerships to marriages because there are so many similarities. Both are life-changing relationships that require mutual trust and respect. Both involve money. Both require a conscious choice every day to work towards a common goal together. And if you pick the wrong person and the relationship goes sour, your whole world will be rocked. But despite the risks, I always wanted and have had a partner in business. It's way better than taking on the incredible stress of building a business by yourself. And that's also how my guest today felt. Her name is Ruth Zuckerman, and she's long been known as a visionary in the fitness space. She co-founded SoulCycle, then left to co-found Flywheel. Both businesses were launched with two other people, and Ruth will be the first to tell you that those relationships were not always easy. There have been many challenges with partners that have led to serious issues in running her businesses, but Ruth has persevered using lessons from these partnerships to learn more about herself and in turn grow as a businesswoman. While she has provided transformative experiences for students over the years, she herself has been transformed by the lessons learned through the ups and downs with partners at SoulCycle and Flywheel. I was really curious to understand what Ruth had learned and how she faced those challenges of difficult partners over the years. What was it that still kept her going? How did she navigate challenging relationships and build industry-changing companies? That's what I asked when I sat down with Ruth recently. Coming up after the break, we'll learn exactly what it takes to build winning partnerships. When it comes to building and maintaining IT systems, smaller businesses wrestle with slim budgets and resource constraints. At the same time, they're pressured to deliver agility, security, and a great experience for their customers. How can small businesses transform their IT infrastructure without breaking the bank or straining personnel? Cisco. Cisco solves a small business networking puzzle. And there's three things they do particularly well and also that can help. Number one, look for a networking solution that's easy to deploy, operate, and manage, so it can scale seamlessly when it's time to expand. Number two, security is top of mind for everyone, especially small businesses that might not have the people or bandwidth to monitor the network as closely as they'd like. For that reason, it's key to look for security features that offer automation and are easy to deploy and use. And number three, businesses that don't think they can afford to make an upfront investment in technology might want to ask about leasing and financing options. There are many easy ways to spread your payments out over time while avoiding technology obsolescence. So, visit cisco.com/go/HSH to discover our current promotions and free trials and explore the small business portfolio. That's visit Cisco, cisco.com/go/HSH. Again, you'll be able to discover current promotions and free trials and explore the small business portfolio. And now, on with the show. All right, now let's get into my conversation with Ruth Zuckerman. I recently visited with her out in Sag Harbor, New York. She left Flywheel in 2018 and is now thinking about her next business idea. So I got right to it and started by asking Ruth about partnerships and the challenges they provided for her.
While I can't tell you exactly what happened and go into the details of how it all played out, I certainly can talk about what my approach was at the time and why I didn't have the proper legal protection. And a lot of that is kind of things I learned in hindsight about myself and through my own work in therapy and the evolution I've experienced, I've been able to understand how to not repeat the same mistakes. If I had been legally protected in the right way, it wouldn't have hurt me quite as much as it did. But what I learned is how important it is when you're picking partners in business to really understand the dynamic, how it's going to play out, what you bring to the table that might cause a problem or be a strength. And I certainly learned a lot because I heard a lot from that experience. And it absolutely helped me in terms of the next partnership that I went into at Flywheel, and I was legally protected from the get-go. I always was someone who would just knee-jerk reaction would always be to defer to everybody else and never kind of trust my own gut. And sometimes when you do that, you end up deferring to the wrong people and you end up taking the wrong advice. And unfortunately, that's what happened.
Now did that sense of deferring to other people and and in your early stages of business, because you're 48 when you started SoulCycle, but still in terms of developing as a person, it seems like for you, it was very difficult to kind of take charge and have a voice. And does that come, I know, from growing up? I know you have talked about having a domineering mother and being able to find your voice.
Yes, that's really how I was wired from very early on. And yes, my mother was narcissistic and dominating, and she always knew more than I did and knew better than I did. And that was always ingrained in me. So it was very familiar behavior and a very familiar pattern that unfortunately repeated itself in many areas of my life. I was also never someone who was very business savvy. I grew up in a family of doctors and people in the medical field and health field, and I just wasn't even around business people. So as a result, I was very trusting, and that's not always the best trait in business, I'm sad to say.
No, because I could imagine now when SoulCycle started, and you can tell us about that, but I remember and recall, as I told you, I had taken classes of yours when you were an instructor at Reebok, and you were it. I mean, you kind of really brought that energy in. And what I think you brought, as I said in the intro, was you brought that kind of soul and emotional transformation that you really sell early on. And I think there were obviously people who saw that in you. And then how did it happen? Did they approach you? Because, you know, in my mind, if I'm a business person, like, this woman is doing something right and people are lining up for her classes, let's go start a studio. I assume, is that how it happened?
That's exactly how SoulCycle happened. I was approached by a rider of mine who actually started taking my classes out here, out east on Long Island, when I would teach in East Hampton at the time at another studio that was in existence then. And she followed me to the fall at the Reebok Club and approached me one day after class and simply said, I want to open a boutique spin-only business in New York. I have the capital to do it. However, I don't know anything about teaching spin classes. I just know that I love your class and I would love it to be about the way you teach. I would love your method to kind of be the force in this business. The secret sauce. Thank you. And I would want you to be the face of the business. What do you think? And I literally said, I'm in within 30 seconds and was thrilled because this was an idea that I had and that I had wanted to do, but I didn't have the capital. I didn't have any experience in business. So I didn't necessarily think I could get a loan. Sure. And here was my opportunity as far as I was concerned.
And this is where I assume, as you said, coming up and you knowing you, you're very trusting and warm person. I assume this is where you're, hey, like you said, I'm all in and trusting these people to start this business. And you do start the business. And,
exactly.
And what happens? How does it get going? And how do you put it into play?
So an important component, which I left out, is that I had another friend who was a huge fan of my class, and I met her at the Reebok Club, and she started taking my class regularly, had recently moved to New York from LA, and she and I used to talk about this dream of opening a business together, but she didn't have the capital either. I'm a very loyal person, which goes along with warm and trusting. And I mentioned her to Elizabeth, who was the person who had approached me. And I asked her if she'd be open to meeting Julie, and she said she would. And so I arranged a lunch for the three of us, and the two of them hit it off. And that became the founding partnership of
SoulCycle. So you basically and put all three of you together and really connected Julie and Elizabeth.
I did.
And put SoulCycle into motion. So you connect everybody, right? And then you have the capital, you start. How do you start? What happens? What did you have to do?
So first and foremost, we found our space, which was a beat up dance studio on West 72nd Street in the back of a building, street level. It was literally an old dance studio, wood floors, one wall was mirrored, and that was it. One bathroom, one long, narrow hallway leading to the studio. And our office space, quote unquote, was probably 4 feet by 2 feet. We could barely fit in it.
And can't fit a bike in there.
You couldn't. And we bought our desk, which we assembled from IKEA, our front desk, and built some cubicles to throw the shoes into. And we opened our doors in the spring of 2006. And in the beginning, I taught probably 21, 22 classes a week because, I still can't believe I did it. I was exhausted.
Tired, yeah.
And keep in mind, I had two twin girls in high school at home, and I was a single mom.
I feel for
so,
you.
So thank you. So
for it, you back then.
It was a lot. Thank you. But I loved it because I was so thrilled about this business. And we started to hire other instructors, but in the beginning, I didn't trust anyone because I wanted to make sure I could bring as much as my of my following as possible that I'd spent 5 years building at the Reebok Club. So I wanted them to have me as the experience. Sure enough, in not a lot of time, we sold out our first class, and then I knew we were going to make it. And I would say in the end, I probably brought over about 80% of my following.
Yeah.
Well, you know that,
yeah,
Robert.
100%.
Yes. And, everyone came.
A lot of, you know, and that's why then a lot of the Equinoxes of the world at the time and Reeboks were empty. They're cycling because everyone was going for this experience. And that's what you delivered. You really delivered a transformative experience. And it sounds like, to backpedal a little, I know when you started instructing, you, or actually, I'm sorry, before you even started instructing, when you initially started taking spinning classes, you were going through a divorce. Is that the first time you got on a bike and you kind of felt this cathartic experience?
It was. It was the very first time I'd been in a spin class. I decided I'm going to try this. And yeah, I guess because I was going through this traumatic experience at the time, it just worked for me. And I noticed it literally in the first class that I took, that something happened. And by the end of the 45 minutes, I felt empowered. I felt stronger. And I felt like I could seize the day, conquer the issues, whatever it was for that day.
Yeah. And I think what I've seen or have heard too was, once you did start instructing after you were taking classes, you were able to open up and be vulnerable while you were leading this class. And I think that is what people really took to. And I imagine when you start SoulCycle and you're looking at all these new instructors, you want to make sure that they can also deliver that experience, because that, to me, was the secret sauce.
100%. And that became part of the training process when we would bring new people in to become instructors. That was an important part. It wasn't just learning the physical method, but it was, what can you share with your class and what has happened to you, and can you be vulnerable so that they can connect with you?
Yeah. And it seems like, I'm sure you must have had people who would come up to you after class and want to share, and you spoke
always
to me.
Always. And it never got old for me, and it still doesn't get old for me, because it just is incredibly gratifying for me to give the incredible experience that I had when I took spin classes to as many people as possible.
Yeah. Well, I think we're living today in this experiential economy where people, you know, whether it's Starbucks or whatever it might be, you're really buying the experience. And the guys who kind of penned this experiential economy, Pine and Gilmore, who wrote this book on it, said that we're in the experiential economy, but the ultimate economy that's going to come after the experiential economy is the transformative economy. And those are experiences that lead to transformations. And I think SoulCycle and Fly and you initially going way back to Reebok, that's what you were really delivering. You were delivering transformative experiences. And that's why you had these people coming up to you after class. And I'm sure that's why you had tons of people who were become people, forgive the word, said SoulCycle was cultish. And did you find that being the case?
That it was cultish?
Yes.
I did. So much of our success was purely from word of mouth. We never advertised, barely marketed. And
but you used to have, I remember when you first started the first one, this little cart outside.
The rickshaw.
The rickshaw.
Yes. And the reason we had the rickshaw, and as I said before, you know, success came pretty quickly in the scheme of things, but we had our usual startup hiccups. And one of them was we signed the lease and then on this space, and then we found out that there would be no signage allowed because of historic reasons. And again, as I said, we were in the back of a building.
Sure.
So we went into a complete panic. What are we going to do? How are people going to find us? And so Elizabeth actually came up with the idea of painting this rickshaw cart yellow, the SoulCycle yellow, and we'll put it outside. And that's how we will let people know we're there. But the interesting thing is that ironically, not having signage actually became a positive because it became kind of that club that you had to know about to go there.
Like the
and then you feel
that,
very cool.
No,
and I think that in a strange way, it dictated the culture
That's
that ended up building from SoulCycle. And it was cultish and it kind of took on that aura of I'm cool because I know about this place and my friend told me about it, and hence the word of mouth. And I think all of that contributed to this cultish feeling.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So getting back to the partnership. So you guys, you launched the first studio and obviously it becomes very successful and things are going well. How's the partnership going at that point, let's say in those first 6 months to a year? And do you, what's going on with everything?
You know what, Robert? I actually thought it was going well. Again, in hindsight, maybe not so well. And I can confidently say that I wasn't picking up on the cues and maybe I didn't want to. Maybe I couldn't believe it. We went into this as equal partners and as we should have. And I don't know, again, going back to what I was saying before, being a very trusting person, I never, ever fathomed in a million years that it would play out in the way that it did. But I, as I said, I didn't pick up on the cues, but they were there.
Right. And what were some of those cues? What was it that you didn't realize or I guess your partners thought was going on at the time?
I think that one of the biggest culprits probably was lack of good communication between partners. And again, shame on me for not really effectively picking up on issues that I guess were there, but I didn't face them at the time. And they didn't communicate them very well to me. So that didn't help in terms of being able to pick up on them. And who knows, maybe a decision was made before I knew it about whether this partnership was going to work or not. And I just wasn't included in on it. I don't know. But ultimately, it did feel like I was blindsided and never a good feeling.
No, not for anything.
Yes.
And, you know, especially when I look at you and going from Soul and then we'll get to it in a little bit with Flywheel, you know, people come knocking to your door because again, you are the secret sauce. And I assume, did it happen where, you know, look, you said you were teaching tons of classes at the beginning.
Yes.
I don't like, for what part of the bargain, and a lot of times with partnerships, it's like you're not holding your end of the bargain. I'm working so hard. But I would imagine at that start, like you're doing 20, 25 classes a week. You're building up what really is, again, the secret sauce, the finding the right instructors. What was it that you weren't living up to, or was that not even the case?
I don't think it was the case.
Right.
And it's complex, the reasons, and it gets into personalities and insecurities, if you will.
Yeah.
And I can't go much further than that.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. And I totally understand. I mean, from being in myself with my businesses, having partners, it's the hardest thing. And when you're dealing with personalities and spouses and whatnot, it really can get extremely complex and it's not what you're thinking about. So what did you learn from these issues with your partners? And then you took on to, we'll get to Flywheel right now, I guess.
Yeah.
What was it that you learned and what you were looking for?
Well, again, as we touched upon before, first and foremost, legal protection, because at the end of the day, there are so many situations where people go into business with partners who they don't necessarily know that well. Yeah. So I can't sit here and say, oh, you have to know your partner really well, because it just doesn't work out that way.
And even when you know them super well, sometimes people change, and it's just smart to get everything legally done and put it away, and it sounds like then go into business.
Exactly. I actually just heard of a situation with two business partners who knew each other for 20 years and it didn't work out. So yes, it does. That doesn't even matter. With my partners at Flywheel, there was just this instant respect that the three of us had for each other and the respect that we had for each other's areas of expertise. And so we knew very early on and talked about the fact that, yes, we all wanted to feel comfortable lending our opinions in areas that might not have been our wheelhouse. But at the end of the day, we were ready to defer to each other's expertise when it came to a final decision on something.
You stayed in your lanes and you focused on what you knew and then came
exactly.
together.
And we respected each other's talent in each area. And we just gelled in that way. And I think that was a huge difference. All three of us were very different too. So we complemented each other well. And we all wanted the same thing, which was to just be really successful and build a great community and a great culture. And that was a very different experience for me in that the cultures in SoulCycle and Flywheel were drastically different. And I really believe that ultimately cultures happen and are defined by the founders, and there's a trickle-down kind of effect that happens. And ultimately at Flywheel, we decided that we wanted the culture to feel kind of all inclusive. At SoulCycle, it was much more exclusive, and both obviously proved to work. For me, being all inclusive, which was much more consistent with who I am and my personality.
Sure, I can't imagine anything not being that
and
way.
And I do feel that ultimately the exclusivity was more consistent with Julie and Elizabeth. And again, it worked and it was super successful as we know.
It was like the VIP club, you know, that
totally.
You get into and you're part of, but there's
yes.
other members who aren't part of it. And it sounds like
exactly.
at Flywheel, you wanted to go into this and be this inclusive place. And
yes.
I think you did stadium seating. Was that a big difference than SoulCycle?
Definitely. And that's a really huge point, which is starting again, second time around, has its disadvantages, but it also has a lot of advantages. I learned a lot about what worked and what didn't work. And we were able to capitalize on the points that could have been improved upon. So stadium seating was a perfect example. There was always the concern back in the day in a spin class of getting a quote unquote good bike, you know, being in the front row. What's the best bike? And
I'd always be in the back in like some dark corner. And
exactly.
Like, but sometimes people like want to be back there. Sometimes
yes.
I'm like, I'm hiding because I'm not that great. So,
right.
But yes, there's a lot more people who you want to be right up there, right?
And
exactly. if you have a setup that's not conducive to everyone seeing the instructor.
That's right. And so obviously with stadium seating and every level is raised, you can see the instructor from every single bike. And more importantly, the instructor can see every rider in the class. And again, going back to what's always been important to me, it's the connection between the instructor and the rider. So with everybody seeing everybody, it goes both ways. It's reciprocal and effective. And forgive me, but you also don't have someone's butt in your face. And that
yes.
happens too back
yes.
in the day
yes.
and happened.
And depending on whose butt it is, it could be a lot worse than
exactly.
you know, what you can imagine.
So people really appreciated the stadium concept.
Yeah. What other ways did you think that, or do you know that Flywheel and Soul are different in terms of culture?
Another really important thing for us when we started out at Flywheel was to just be able to give the best customer service possible, which again was a bit of a differentiator that comes with exclusive versus
sure.
inclusive. In an exclusive kind of environment, every single customer might not get the best treatment. You know, some might get more than others. Celebrities might get more than others. That was, again, a differentiator for us. We knew we would get celebrities in, especially being in New York City. You're going to get that. And it's, believe me, it's great
yeah,
for
yeah.
your business to have a celebrity. But we wanted to treat everyone like a celebrity because, by the way, the customer that comes and takes a class 6 days a week is probably more important than a celebrity because
yes.
they're paying the bills,
yes.
right?
No, it's all about the experience and giving that experience to those customers
yes.
because, you know, and I know from Flywheel, because my wife has gone a lot, and she'd come back and say, oh, Sting was there today. And, yes. And I mean, just you name it, like there's tons of celebrities coming in there. But if you're a business and you're just focused on that and you really forget about that consumer who's coming 6 days a week, they're going to notice that. And exactly. Your business isn't going to be around for long.
Exactly. And so that was first and foremost for us. Little things, you know, at Seoul, in the beginning at least, when there were just a few studios, the hallways were kind of narrow. So we were noticing
yeah,
like that the sweaty bodies like, and the clean
bodies.
I'm really
sweaty and I'd feel so bad. Like exactly. I'd be like coming out of there and trying not to touch anyone. And
exactly. So that was another design decision for us when we were building our spaces, is to have wide hallways so sure. people wouldn't have to deal with that. So again, just learning so much from my first business. And obviously with Fly, we differentiated ourselves through our product. And Jay, my co-founder, is the one who came up with this idea of adding metrics to the bike. And then
right.
that took it to a whole nother level.
Now that's a big difference.
Huge.
The one thing that I look at, you brought in these metrics where you can actually see, I guess, your RPMs. And obviously Fly wasn't Seoul wasn't doing that at this time. And did that bring another element? Was it a good element with competitiveness?
It did. I mean, it definitely defined our crowd in that they were more competitive because they just latched onto these numbers and saw that at the end of the day or the end of the ride, they could actually compete with themselves. It wasn't necessarily about having to compete sure. with other people in the room. It was really about competing with yourself, having this score at the end of your ride so that you can up it
right.
every time you come.
So you can see where you are and
see
you
your
can
progress.
Look, and any goals like that obviously make you want to come more and
exactly.
make you want to do better. And I that's a great idea.
Yeah. And then again, adding torque boards. So these flat screens in the front of the
what
room, that was our word for, we would put up two flat screens up on against the front wall so everybody could see them. And if you wanted to, if you were that competitive, you would opt onto the screen and that meant that your username would be up on the screen with your score, ongoing total score during the course of the class so you could compare yourself to other riders. And if you chose not to be on it, you could still compare yourself
oh,
to the riders
right.
on the screen.
You knew what your score was
exactly.
and you can look up and
so
see.
So you can go either way.
And then once you get it up there, you'll be like, all right, I'll put my name up there. And
exactly. exactly.
Okay, so partnership. So at the time you leave Seoul, they start expanding and doing well,
mm-hmm.
and you join Fly, and
yes.
you guys start doing well. You're such a lovely, wonderful person, warm. And did you have a competitiveness in you, though? Like, hey, I want to kick their ass.
Definitely, I did. How could I not? And boy, is that a successful driving tool in making your own business do well
yeah.
and prosper. So it worked well.
Yeah. Now I can imagine it could drive you a little crazy, but at the same time, it could really help you to build a business.
Exactly. And again, speaking to the success of my partnership at Flywheel, my two partners were equally driven. Knowing my story from SoulCycle and being somewhat protective of me, which I always appreciated
that.
Of them, they were just as driven.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. Masterclass. I love this company. They provide exclusive access to online courses taught by masters of their craft. It's amazing. Imagine being able to learn economics from Paul Krugman or writing from Malcolm Gladwell. My personal favorite is the Business Leadership course by one of my entrepreneurial heroes, Starbucks own Howard Schultz. Masterclass, it's such a great idea for a business. No joke, I had a similar idea back in 1998. I partnered with former NBA legend Alex English, and we created videos of Alex teaching how to shoot and pass. Our thought was, what better way to learn than from an NBA legend? Unfortunately, tech-wise, we were a bit ahead of our time, but Masterclass has made it happen in a big way. How great would it be to learn poker from Phil Ivey or cooking from Chef Thomas Keller? Maybe you always wanted to learn filmmaking. How about learning techniques from Hollywood director Ron Howard? Masterclass provides exclusive access to be able to learn from the best in the world, whether it's business, design, cooking, filmmaking, writing, you name it. And Masterclass literally has the biggest minds in the world teaching exclusive online courses to their members. As a listener of How Success Happens, you know that the successful entrepreneurs we talk to on the show often speak about key knowledge they gain from mentors or experts that help them grow their business. Now you can literally have access to hundreds of the best teachers in the world through Masterclass. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every Masterclass. And as a How Success Happens listener, you get 15% off the annual All Access Pass. Go to masterclass.com/HSH. That's masterclass.com/HSH for 15% off Masterclass. And our next sponsor. When it comes to building and maintaining IT systems, small businesses often wrestle with slim budgets and resource constraints. At the same time, they're pressured to deliver the same agility, security, and great experience for their customers as larger businesses. How can small businesses transform their IT infrastructure without breaking the bank or straining personnel? Cisco. Solving the small business networking puzzle is what Cisco does. And here are three tips and areas that Cisco can help you with. One, look for networking solution that's easy to deploy, operate, and manage, so it can scale seamlessly when it's time to expand. Two, security should always be top of mind for everyone, especially small businesses that might not have the people or bandwidth to monitor the network as closely as they'd like. For this reason, it's key to look for security features that offer automation and are easy to deploy and use. Three, businesses that don't think they can afford to make an upfront investment in technology might want to ask about leasing and financing options. There are many easy ways to spread your payments out over time while avoiding technology obsolescence. So visit Cisco, that's CISCO.com/go/HSH, to discover our current promotions and free trials and explore the small business portfolio.
And we're back. So Fly gets going. The partnership is working out extremely well. Tell us about the growth. How did it happen? And you had venture-backed money, so were you building a lot of studios, other studios outside of New York? How did you get it going?
We were. And really, our growth was so organic. And I say that because, obviously, started in New York. Our flagship studio was in the Flatiron District. Nothing was there, so we had no competition in the beginning.
Nowadays, you go down there, it's like boutique heaven.
It is the most saturated area for boutique fitness. So my partner David.
And this is 2010, right?
Yes. Okay. So my partner David was a visionary in terms of choosing that space. So we started there. And then our second studio happened March 27th, which I'll always remember because it's my birthday.
Yeah, there you go.
And that was my birthday
nice
gift.
Present.
Yes, to open on the Upper West Side. And then we opened a studio in Boca Raton very early on, purely because we had a rider who said, I spend half my year there. I think it would be a great community for you guys. You should come down and look at it. So we said, okay, sure. And we did. Great. And that was our first location outside of New York.
I love it. Don't have to pay a big consulting firm to tell you where to open.
At all. And really, that's how our growth happened.
Sure.
And we wanted to do it as quickly as possible. That was our philosophy. And we did. And so to bring you to 2014.
Yeah, by that's 4 years in.
4 years in. By that point, we had 22 studios.
Wow.
And that was the, I'm jumping ahead, obviously, but that was the time when we decided to sell. And it was a big decision for us, but we just felt that at that point, a lot of copycats were coming up into the marketplace.
It seems like there's tons of spin studios.
It was really happening. And we thought this would be our opportunity to really scale in a much bigger way. And we were also tired. It was 4 years of 24/7 working our butts off.
Were you also teaching a lot at this point too?
Constantly.
And I imagine you have to go to all the different studios and teach them
flying
what a teacher
everywhere
is.
And helping with the training. We obviously built our training team and it became bigger and bigger as we
increased.
Was
that your vision? Is that the lane you stayed in?
It
so was your vision.
To always be responsible for everything, we would say for everything that went on within the four walls of the studio. Anything on the creative end was my wheelhouse. So that all went into our decision to sell in 2014.
Now, who'd you sell to? How did it come about?
So it came about, again, organically. We started to generate interest. People were approaching us about wanting to possibly buy the company. We came very close to a deal with a particular company. I can't say who it was, but...
Was it a competitor or was it
No, actually, it wasn't.
Okay.
It wasn't someone in boutique fitness or even in the gym business to that end. So what happened was one of our riders told her dad, hey, you got to try this business. It's amazing. And he was already a very successful business person who owned several businesses at the time. She brought him in to take a class. He fell in love with it. He became a very strategic investor for us in 2012. And he got wind that we were very close to a deal and basically stepped in and said, if anyone's buying this business, I am.
And it's a good feeling, right?
A great feeling. And that was how that acquisition happened. And his background was retail, very successful in the retail realm. And yeah, he bought Flywheel in 2014, April to be specific, and it kind of became a family business. His family became very involved in the workings of it. And that was when Flywheel started growing to a whole nother level.
Right. Now you stayed involved.
I did.
When you sold, was that something at the point where, hey, Ruth has to be there if I'm buying this business?
Yes, it was. And a lot happened that, again, not being familiar with business at this level, a lot happened that I didn't predict. And my two co-founders were out within the next 2 months.
Onto the next thing.
They were onto something else. And I didn't anticipate that. And that was tough for me. It kind of felt like all of a sudden I was operating without a safety net.
Yeah.
You know, they were always very protective of me and supportive and encouraging. And not only were they now gone, but the whole culture was shifting and it was becoming much more corporate, which I understand happens in these situations.
They were looking to scale the business.
Totally. And again, not my comfort level, even down to using language that I didn't understand.
Right.
Like I always talk
corporate
about,
talk.
Yes, or submit your strategic operative initiative by the end of, by the EOD. And I
what
was like, what? What are we
EOD?
Talking about here? Literally
end
someone,
day, guess,
yeah,
right?
Someone whispered in my ear, Ruth, it just means what's your plan? And I couldn't understand why they didn't just say that, but no, it doesn't work that way. So let's just say I learned a lot, but it was definitely a growth period for me in that. And when I say that, I mean personal growth, because I had to learn on a new level, kind of how to understand my value and have the confidence to eventually kind of turn to this new leadership team and say, hey, this isn't really working well for me and I need to figure out how to make this a better fit. And that was a big deal for me to kind of stand up and say, it's not working for me. And ultimately it was a good thing because they kind of turned around and looked at me and said, okay, what will work for you? And what's your vision in terms of your role? And it ended up becoming a very productive conversation. And I was able to kind of restructure my role and get it back to, again, more face-to-face with my instructors. And again, getting back to connection with riders and employees. And so that helped a lot. But again, not enough to ultimately cause me to feel as comfortable and as happy as I was when the business was in its growing stages. And ultimately I left, which was, you know, the end of 2018, because it didn't really feel like me anymore.
Yeah. So I want to get to that point when you left, but going back to this important point, what I love, and on this podcast, we talk about growth and about learning. And I love how you're learning, you're, you know, 40s to 50s, like you're still learning. And it sounds like initially when you were scared to go to them, or not scared, but hesitant.
Mm-hmm. I was scared. I was scared too.
Was that a self-esteem issue? Is that something? Because to me, it's like, wow, this woman, she's the reason for Soul. She was the reason these guys came to her fly. She built really from that teacher at Reebok, she established these two, probably the top boutique fitness. Someone listening might be like, I would be walking like I'm on top of the world, but
you're
you weren't.
100% right. Spot on. Definitely self-esteem issues. And unfortunately, in now this iteration of Flywheel, I seemed to have found myself with people who, how do I say this, weren't really encouraging my self-esteem. Yeah. So that didn't help me, especially when my tendency was to doubt myself. So that wasn't a great environment for me in terms of, again, finding myself with people that were very different from my Flywheel co-founder.
Yeah, because it sounds like your co-founders, it was the perfect partnership.
Yes.
Because they really, they saw maybe what you didn't see in yourself and this value, and they encouraged that. And that helped you probably have more, I'm not a psychiatrist.
You're doing a good job now. Okay.
But that helped you really find that confidence to say, hey, look, this is what I want. And then maybe the confidence to say, this is not what I want and I'm going to walk away. And is that what happened?
It is. And again, definitely a personal growth period, because as we just talked about, I got to a place where I stood up and said, A, B, and C isn't working. But the final ultimate decision was, hey, maybe this really isn't the best environment for me. And that's really what drove me to decide to ultimately leave. I also, which I know we were going to touch upon, I guess it was a year and a half or 2 years before I left, was when I was starting to work on my book. And then that became kind of this side project that was really exciting for me. I wrote the book to have the opportunity to kind of just reach a wider audience with everything I would do in my daily spin class. And the book wasn't encouraged by the current leadership team sure. at that time. And so that was hard for me too.
That's so hard when, yes. you know, especially as a founder, and where all of a sudden they're putting the handcuffs on you and you need to be creative. And it sounded like you need to do this at the time. And the book, obviously, Riding High, How I Kissed SoulCycle Goodbye, Co-Founded mm-hmm. Flywheel, and Built the Life I Always Wanted, is yes. out now. And for you, in terms of that book, was it therapy writing that book for you? And what did you want to really express in the book?
It was definitely a cathartic experience to literally go back to birth and review my life up to that point. So yes, very cathartic, but also very empowering. And as I said previously, it really was about being able to empower a larger group of people. And sure enough, I kind of got the same response from my book that I would at the end of a class, which was people contacting me, reaching out to me and saying, I related to so much of what you wrote. This part resonated with me. That part resonated with me. And that just really was incredibly gratifying for me.
Yeah. So now you wrote the book. You step away from Flywheel. You had been really working pretty much in a business since, was 06 when SoulCycle?
Yes.
So you're doing this literally up 14 or so years. How was that just stepping away into, I guess you had the book, but did you just step away completely and like chill out, or can you chill out?
It was tough, and I'm still in that kind of period of uncertainty, which I think is tough for everyone.
Yeah. It's like being in a hallway, I like to equate it to, because I'm in a similar situation now where I had sold my business and stepped away and kind of in this hallway figuring out what's next.
Yes,
and
so
it's
true.
Hard to be here.
It is hard. And people do say, oh, well, enjoy it. Look, you can relax. But the thing is, it's hard to relax when you're living with uncertainty, because yes. uncertainty kind of equates to anxiety, and it's hard. At the same time, physically took time off the bike for the first time in 21 years.
Wow.
And that was super helpful for my body.
What did you do? So did you, because you went from
21 years on a bike, which, and for most of those 20 years, it's all I did.
Did you do nothing when, or did you just completely stop, or did you take up yoga, or?
I did spend time doing nothing except walking. That's
wow.
all I did. I was having some lower back issues. Sure. And so I took the time to really dive into physical therapy, and that really helped me. And then eventually I just had to get back to the bike, because again, I needed it probably mentally more than physically, again, during this time, which is difficult emotionally. And sure enough, once I got back to the bike, even just taking classes, it was incredibly helpful for me. And
so did you, when you're like in a class, I could imagine the instructors pretty intimidated, like seeing Route Zuckerman sitting in her class? Like, do you go over to them beforehand? It's like always. Michael Jordan, you know, playing basketball against Jordan or something.
I appreciate that, Robert. But, you know, and then I never understand it because I think I'm the nicest, warmest person. Who would ever be intimidated by me? But it happens. And I always would give them the heads up that I'm coming. And truthfully, there might be a little intimidation, but I think the more overpowering feeling is one of excitement because people love to ride with me and I love to ride with my former instructors who I just think the world of, and it's a win-win.
Today in going to classes, there's so many different instructors, and it still goes back to why when I ask people why they go into these cyclings, it's always the instructor. And it seems like, you know, you have started this and there's just like so many of these personalities out there now and like different types, and but they all go back to kind of, I think, that transformation and being open about stuff that you really, really initiated early on. Like, do you look at these instructors now kind of glowing and wow, this is, you know, or is it sometimes like, okay, it's a little much?
Sometimes it does feel a little much. And I have to pinch myself to remind myself that yes, I was a pioneer in the industry. And again, being who I am and having grown up with self-esteem issues, it doesn't come easily for me, the success. And it's funny because it wasn't until Jay, one of my co-founders at Flywheel, one day said to me, I was having a hard day and I was having difficult thoughts about SoulCycle and the way it ended. And he turned around and said to me, you know, why don't you think about it in a positive way and kind of, and why don't you accept the fact that you didn't start one, you started two wildly successful national businesses. And that was a very important day for me because it did turn things around for me and allowed me, I gave myself permission to own that. And that, you know, talk about something like that helping self-esteem, it certainly did.
None of those businesses, both of these other businesses, Soul or Fly, without any of the other people involved, could have happened. Without you, they never would have happened.
And so, I can honestly sit here and agree with you because they wouldn't have.
That's great.
Thank
and you.
You
should own it. Okay, so now I want to ask you two things, and we have a little bit more time. One, before kind of what's next and ask your questions on the boutique industry. I heard a story that the founder of Peloton, who I think you know pretty well, may have even been in your classes, John Foley, mm-hmm. had approached you guys while you were at Fly to partner or to do the Peloton business together. Now, is that an accurate story or?
It's a very accurate story. And at the time, our chairman as of 2014, who actually wasn't our chairman then, but he was, as I said before, a very strategic advisor, investor and advisor for us, felt strongly that if Flywheel was going to do an at-home bike, that we would do our own and that we didn't need to partner with John. And so that was the ultimate reasoning behind the decision.
Do you ever look back? I mean, and be like, okay.
Yes,
okay,
I do.
I don't even need to go there. I get that. I mean, we've all been there. We've all been even non-entrepreneurs, and I should have invested in Google back in, you know, 2000
all of
or whatever.
Us, yes,
so,
for sure.
Okay. But let me ask you this. It also has been talked about, I guess, you leaving Flywheel. Some people say, this is the end of boutique spinning. And like we talked about before, there's tons of these boutique fitness classes going on right now, spinning. Mm-hmm. And where do you think the industry is, first off, spinning and then boutique fitness as a whole? And do you know something we don't know?
I would like to say I do, but I'm not sure I do. And interestingly, in this period that I'm in right now, I have some of the same questions. And I've been spending a lot of time meeting with everyone and anyone in the industry to get different people's opinions on it. I do believe it's so oversaturated right now. The boutique fitness business is everywhere. There's no question that it seems to be going in the direction of at-home products, whether it's Peloton, the Mirror, which is also doing quite well. People are embracing that. I do. My true belief is that at the end of the day, there will always be room for both. And if we're talking about spinning specifically, I have said this from day one, ever since I started spinning, there will always be room for spinning, and it will always be successful because people can grow old with it. People can do it at any age.
It's easier on the body, right?
It is. It's low impact. I literally have someone who's taking my classes now in Sag Harbor who has been riding with me since the Reebok days, who is 80 years old. And he's as strong as most of the people in the classes.
That's so great.
So I think for that reason alone, it's here to stay. And I also think that with spinning especially, the group energy is so important, and it's so, what's the word? Just addictive in a certain way. People feed off of each other.
Can you get that with the, you know, this is my, I love fitness or boutique fitness because of exactly what you just said, that community, that energy. And yes, hopping on your Peloton bike is easy. But for me, what I love is that feeling of being part of that community and team. So it seems like they're both working out pretty well right now. But like you think, I guess that's why boutique fitness is here to stay.
Yes. And I think, as I said, there will be room for both. However, the biggest change in the industry in boutique fitness is that, I'm sorry to say, that the days of someone patronizing a boutique fitness industry that only offers one genre, the days of that person coming to that business 6-7 days a week, I would say, are over. And that's the biggest difference now. People are doing what...
They're mixing it up.
They're mixing it up. Someone gave me the term exercise snacking, and I really like that.
I love that.
Because it's true. People are doing different things. And by the way, that's a good thing. It's good physically for your body to change it up and cross train, as you will. So in that sense, the businesses have changed a lot. That being said, I still think you can open a boutique fitness business, but you probably need to offer a couple of two or three different options.
Gotcha. So for you, for what's next, and I, knowing how your mind works, I'm sure you're thinking, is it definitely something you want to do right now in fitness, I would imagine, or are you going to completely do a 180?
I don't have a definitive decision yet or answer to that. However, my inclination would be it will be something fitness related, purely because it's what I do, and I will always want to connect with people. And for me, I can't think of a better way to do it than through physical exercise.
How long do you think we're going to have to wait to see what Ruth Zuckerman is doing? Are you taking the summer off? Well, you're not even taking off. You're teaching classes now,
yes,
right?
Yes, I am teaching classes, but my answer would be I really hope not too much longer.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Always inspirational, aspirational, everything.
Thanks, Robert. Again.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. Or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman. Or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business. Or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.